This is Anne DeVore, A Gift of Feeling, February 11th, 2011.
Our speaker tonight, Anne DeVore, has been here many times before. She's talked about sand play. She's talked about defenses of the self. And the lectures that have, I think we really identify with her are on William Butler Keats and Maud Gonne. And I always think of Anne as our literary analyst because she is so well-versed in the classics and in English literature. Actually, one of her more recent talks was Individuation in Egyptian and Archaic Greek Texts. So I'd like to present Anne, and please come down and check the books. Thank you.
So we do have to say happy birthday, Egypt. I mean, it's really wonderful that today I get to talk to you and my dear ancient language that I love the most, Egyptian, in the modern world is coming back to life. And I think it's really wonderful. So this lecture came about because I asked five of the people who have known me the longest to tell me what they wanted to hear me talk about. I usually pick the topic and hold forth, but this time I decided I would ask the people who knew me best to volunteer their thoughts on what this evening should be about. To my surprise, or maybe not, I don't know, what everyone wanted to know about was me, that I've been very private and there isn't a lot that is known about me. They know that I've been with the same analyst since I was 32 years old, and I still am. He's 90 this year. And so what we came to, several of us, is that it would be interesting for you to hear what the true analysis was about. We could talk about the psychotherapeutic part. We could talk about my development over time as a young person coming into this age. But what I finally came to is that what we had to talk about was what the self wanted to do all of these years. And C.A. Meyer, who was David's teacher, said, "You really can't know what an analysis is about because it's none of your business. It's not the business of the ego. It is the business of the self. And you won't know until it's over what that has been." The other thing I wanted to share with you is what I call the legacy of feeling. My analyst was analyzed, I call it, on the feminine side of the Jungian tree. His primary analyst was Emma Jung, and his other analyst, his training analyst, was C.A. Meyer. These are people who both had very well-developed feeling functions. They were introverted. David and I are introverted. I am a primary feeling type, as was Emma. C.A. Meyer was a primary intuitive type, and David is a primary sensate type. But we meet in feeling. So the key players in David's life, Carl Jung, born in 1875, and he died in 1961 at the age of 85. Emma Jung, who was born in 1882 and died in 1955 at the age of 73. Tony Wolfe, who was born in 1888 and died in 1953 at the age of 64. C.A. Meyer, who was born in 1905 and died in 1995 at the age of 90. the interloper, as we call her, Maria von Franz, who was born in 1915 and died in 1998, and my analyst, David Hart, born in 1920 and is this year 90 years old. The Jung Institute was founded in 1946, and it was named the Institute for... it just went out of my mind. That's the age-related problem. Complex psychology. And there was, as C.A. Meyer said, a more extroverted member who had not been part of the original planning who said, if you don't call it the C.G. Jung Institute, I'm going over to the next town and opening a C.G. Jung Institute. So in 1948, against Jung's desire, because he didn't want a C.G. Jung Institute, in 1948, the Institute for Complex Psychology was renamed the C.G. Jung Institute of Zurich, and he named C.A. Meyer as the director, who was the director until he died, literally. Maria von Franz, that more extroverted person who was very ambitious, was always kind of hoping, you know, everybody would get out of the way. But C.A. Meyer was tenacious, and he stayed there. David was in residence from 1947 to 1957. He was at age 27 when he arrived, and he was 37 when he left. Emma was 65 years old when he met her. She died while he was there. Meyer was 42 when David worked with him at the beginning. Tony Wolfe was 59 when David met her, and he worked with her regarding feminine typology and active imagination. I was born in 1941. In December, I met David when I was 32 years old and he was 53. He is now 90 and I am 69. So it's that long legacy that really stretches back all the way to Emma Jung in 1882 that we're going to talk about. At the time I met David, I was a doctoral student at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and I was working in the Women's Center. My MA was in counseling, and my PhD work was in psychological testing, mainly Rorschach, and in counselor ed. In the course of my work in a women's group, a member remarked that I referenced Jung and Campbell often, and did I know about the summer program in Houston, 2 weeks every August. I called, and they had one place left, and I drove my truck from Boulder to Houston, and that began my actual training and involvement with Jungian analytical psychology. That would have been in 1972. David Hart gave the morning seminars, speaking about fairy tales and dream work. And over the first week, I felt a deep kinship with his work and with his gentle manner. I had my own undergraduate work in German literature, a lifelong interest in fairy tales and mythology, and was sorely in need of the message David was teaching, that is, the value of all persons, but primarily the value of the feminine and the redemption of the feminine at the core of the fairy tales he was working with. At the core of my own psychology was a dark secret, and that is not the subject tonight. What is the subject is my reaction to the events of my early life. Jung said that it is not what happened to us, but our reaction to it that becomes the work of analysis. To be brief, I was the eldest daughter of three, born 7 days after Pearl Harbor. My father was shipping out to the South Pacific and saw me on a 3-day pass. I was not to see him again until he was in a Navy hospital in San Diego when I was 3 years old. In those early days, and thank God, we lived with my father's parents, and I was very bonded to my grandmother. I was held in love and esteem something I believe saved me from the outcome that might have come from those later events. I was a quiet child and strangely aware. My earliest memory is from 10 days old, when I was put under the Christmas tree, and I remember that display of lights above me. There are many instances of that early awakening and the moments of awareness of being contained in a larger reality than in our immediate surroundings. My grandmother played the piano, and very early I learned how to play notes from her hymn books and her pop songs. I figured out watching her, hearing and matching, and then reading the songs, a gift that saved my later life, music. Fast forward to grade school, and my father is again absent, being in college with the GI Bill. By this time, there were three little girls, very little money, and we were living away from my grandmother. My mother had a violent reaction to most things in life, and this would build, and there would be bouts of raging and terrible frenzy. The event that changed my life occurred at age 9, February of my fourth grade year. I witnessed in one of her rages something so horrific that I knew on that day someone would die. I called for help, and when help came, the scene only escalated. Several days later, I wanted to tell someone, and when my mother was out of the apartment, I tried to call my grandmother. I tried to call her on the telephone. My mother came in and I was caught, and I endured a beating that was from then on to be the source of back and neck pain and much shame, as my nose was not my nose, and I felt disfigured and hideous. The wounds were untreated, and ribs, collarbone, upper spine settled into a frozen state, disarranged, and never really comfortable. My reaction to this and to a later event in the sixth grade was the decision to never speak again unless spoken to, and to do whatever I could to get out of there as soon as possible. What saved me was music. I had tested in the third grade as a kid with gifts, and in those days, Colorado schools had excellent music programs. I played violin and then oboe until I graduated from high school. I also had good grades because my parents said I couldn't play music unless I had straight A's. From 7th to the 12th grade, I was in choir, orchestra, band, and I had a good violin teacher. I earned money to go to band camp every summer and there played for the same conductor every summer. He arranged for a scholarship to the University of Southern California for music, and I thought that was my course ahead. When my parents found out I had made my own arrangements, they were incredulous and also demeaning to music and to my impracticality. I was to get an academic scholarship and to study something I could use to support myself. I had no ally at the time I graduated, as my violin teacher died that year of emphysema. In the fall, I headed to the University of Colorado in Boulder, armed with a scholarship that would carry me 4 years. I was 17. I was pretty depressed. I had no goals other than to get the hell out of Dodge. College was okay, not brilliant, and not much of real interest for me. I did the best I could to keep up with the violin, but really it was difficult. No place to practice, no money for a teacher, no orchestra to play in, since only music majors could play in the orchestra. I graduated. I took a job with the American Red Cross in order to get to Europe. Again, that was the goal, certainly not a career path. As it turns out, counseling and human services became the path, more by default than by choice. Remember that I had given up a true voice long ago. There was a curious symptom that I never really examined. I was unable to talk on the telephone. I literally could not make my voice strong enough to make myself heard. No resonance. Could not get those old phones to vibrate or conduct sound. So, fast forward to age 32, and I meet David Hart. And I recognize that this man was to be my analyst. And David lived in Swarthmore, PA. And to work with him, I would have to use the telephone. So that is the beginning of how the finding of the voice that had been lost began, because I literally had to talk to him over an instrument that had been the instrument of that terrible day. The first sessions must have been a mystery to him. I spent them crying and attempting to explain what I needed to work on. This must have been a complete disconnect from the person David had met in Houston, and who was a PhD student who was self-sufficient, socially adept, at least apparently. We began a long conversation, 1973 to present time. We have covered all phases of my life, redeemed my life, solved the deepest dilemmas, and ultimately given me a life I have come to value. Could that have happened in less time? I don't think so. Both David and I believe that individuation continues throughout life, through many developmental stages and phases, age appropriate, always looking forward in the psyche's perspective of becoming and being known. The climate of therapy is the first gift of feeling that I had from David. Over the years, and with steady, consistent nature of my relationship with David and the attitude David has toward me and toward our work, that is the basis for the success, regardless of whatever issue or whatever focus I brought to him at any given time. When I began with David, 1973-74, there was not much known about post-traumatic stress disorder, and that, in retrospect, is certainly what I was dealing with. I had recurring dreams related to the original trauma. I was hypervigilant, reactive to hostile environments to the point of withdrawing, if at all possible. I had no ability to defend myself nor to set reasonable boundaries. David did not work in the framework of diagnosis and prognosis. He simply joined with me in the work with no pressure or expectation that this or that outcome would happen. This is a quote from his book, The Water of Life. Countless times in the course of my work as a psychotherapist, I have come to realize the incomparable value of an attitude that lets the person emerge as herself or himself. This is not so evident as it may seem, since we carry prejudices and expectations into every encounter, and to meet with the other, offers this new realization. He, she hears it as, yes, this is it. I really exist. The person then begins to feel himself or herself emerge without distortion. An inner life that has been walled off and formidable begins to be accessible and natural like an opened garden. He acquired this attitude from his work with Emma Jung and C.A. Meyer, two warm and accepting people who had well-developed feeling and relational presence. He always said, Emma saved my life, and Meyer gave me my life. C.A. Meyer opens his wonderful book, Healing Dreams and Ritual, with this paragraph. The doctor ought to be able to bring about love and reconciliation between the most antithetic elements in the body. Our ancestor, Asclepius, knew how to bring love and concord to these opposites, and he it was, as poets say, and I believe, who founded our art. That is not Meyer, that's Plato from the Symposium, but that is the person that Meyer most identified with in the development of his ideas about therapy. This is another quote from David. Give to whatever one meets its own nature, pure and undisguised. As a healing attitude, this kind of neutrality, whatever its limitations in other relationships, can have unexpected power in therapy. A man with whom I worked said suddenly one day, "You must be doing some kind of magic." He meant that he could not account for the basic rise in self-esteem that had established him on a new level in all areas of his life. I account for this by my persistent, unprejudiced awareness of his true worth, which simply allows that truth to manifest itself. The way to healing is opened by an attitude of giving what is met its true nature. And that's how I experienced David, is that whatever I brought to him, he simply met it. He was open to it. He welcomed it. There was never a feeling of judgment. It was okay, whatever it was. At some point in my work, I remarked that his clients were so lucky, they must all just thrive and grow. He said, "Well, the potential is there for that on my part, and I can hold that potential because my own work with Emma and Meyer was successful. An analyst cannot offer what he or she does not have himself." Because my work was successful, and because yours is progressing, you in your turn will be able to offer that potential to your clients. Related to this issue of transference, Meyer believed that the true transference was of an atmosphere in which the potential for healing was ever present. Because this is largely a psychic shared space, the analyst has the obligation to remain in continuous self-observation and self-development in order to become aware of his and her own limits and shortcomings, one's own blind spots. The clients will present your issues to you, and so you may as well accept that you must work on yourself in order to do this work. You must strive not to burden the client with your own unlived life or unsolved dilemma. Meyer had the conviction that one should stay out of the medical model to resist the savior or parental complex and to attend to what is presented in as benevolent and caring way as possible. One should truly desire that the client find balance and harmony, and that analyst must hold that in potential for the client. The work should be contained within the dream record of the client, so as not to second guess the direction that the psyche wants to go. Psyche knows best what needs to be balanced. The ultimate transference is described in the archaeology of Epidaurus and other pilgrimage sites. Around the temples in trenches are found many clay figures, parts of bodies, a hand, a foot, a heart. These are offered up. And in the grove around the temple, bandages are tied to the limbs of the trees. The hope, the desired outcome of the pilgrimage, the rituals, the dream incubations, is that the illness will be transferred to the bandages and to the offered up body parts. Our job as modern analysts is to provide such an opportunity for the transference of the illness out of the client into the healing space, and for the potential for healing to come to the client, that potential that the analyst holds as the attendant in the process of healing. The atmosphere that David provided for me was palpable. I never doubted that he believed in the work that we were doing. The mystery of healing, the transformation of one's illness into health in the ancient world, depending on the setting of the healing sites, the rituals, and the attitude of the patient, and it cannot be rationally explained nor guaranteed. And David wrote a paper called The Time of Transformation, in which he said, "You can do everything to set up the potential for transformation, but it comes in its own time, according to the needs of the psyche." One aspect of healing is the ritual of the interview with the attendant. The attendant, therapeutes, is the therapist, is what we call ourselves. It literally means attendant. Another aspect is is dependent on the presence of spectators, such as the rites of Dionysus, the tragedies and comedies, and the scapegoat ritual. In modern times, the dreamer is his own witness to the process, because the process, if you're doing dream-centered work, is being given by the psyche. And the analyst is witness to the process. The psyche is the subject and can be revealed, but on its own terms and in its own time. In this model, the analyst acts as attendant, witness to the process. But the remedy, the element needed, must be discovered by the patient himself, and it is there within you, within oneself. What you need is within you. The outcome is dependent on a coming together of the soma kai psyche, the body and the soul, in a new relationship. The healing itself is often felt as a numinous experience, an instance of grace, an inspiriting of life. I have experienced those moments of grace and a resultant deep gratitude for being attended and witnessed over a long time. Another gift of feeling was the feeling function itself. When I began working with David, I was in graduate school. I had already earned a master's, and I was working on a PhD. I was about to add analytical training. I labored and struggled with aspects of the academic work, but accepted the head learning as a necessary preparation for the work that I would do as a counselor. The way I survived was music. I was playing violin as much as I could, playing in the motley group that was to become the Boulder Symphony, and I played chamber music with two other counselors at the University Counseling Center. We had a violin, a cello, and a flutist. And we got pretty good. When we started, it was awful, but we practiced every noon hour, and we actually had a little audience. One day we heard clapping outside of the chamber, and people had decided we were worth listening to. That was the outlet I needed when I just couldn't face another textbook or another exam. I've complained frequently about exhaustion, and David asked if I knew my typology. I had read Jung's Volume 6 carefully and concluded I was operating introverted intuitive as my main, but thought in all seriousness that I was a thinking type, because after all, I was in academia. He quietly set about readjusting my self-concept, saying that exhaustion is often the sign of operating out of type for too long. This was a very hard sell, since the description of introverted feeling was not very flattering, and Jung's bias was that women are feelers, men are thinkers. David had a different idea, and we can read in Meyer's work that he too believed that the gender bias does not hold. In Meyer's work, he describes all of the types. He never corrects Jung. He was a feeler after all. He was, you could say, civil. He simply went about giving male examples of the feeling type and female examples of the thinking type. But, you know, that was his way. He never confronted. The description by Myers on introverted feeling included the information that gave me the insight that David was right. Introverted feeling explained the early mystical experiences, and introverted feeling explained my developed aesthetic and musical interests. David explained time and again that feeling does not equate with emotion or sociability. All people have emotions, and all humans are social beings. Feeling in German was Gefühl, value. It should have been called the valuing function, The basis for this is in the simple preference in the very beginning of life and grew to be the values system that guides a true feeling type. Introverted feeling also explained my reliance on experience as the basis for what I knew to be true, and explained why the fact that the two adjacent functions were present. Had I been introverted intuition, I probably could have had a thinking function that operated. But in fact, I operated out of feeling, and I had introverted intuition because I knew things, uncomfortable as that was to people around me. And I had a well-developed sensation function in my skill in music, as well as my use of the mountains and the forests and general terrain as a source of inspiration and for grounding. It also explained the fact that school and exams and writing in academic style was arduous for me. Thinking was my inferior function. The type was a problem, however, in my Jungian training, introverted feeling, and there was a clear bias against it. Comments that feeling analysts were good at warming people up, but that we should refer them on for the real work. That was the common pronounced attitude in my training group. The other bias was that feeling people weren't that bright, sort of vacuous and bovine. Really, people made those comments in the early 70s. Related to Jung's typology was a second typology that was helpful to understand my place in the world. Tony Wolf proposed a typology of the feminine, four types: the Amazon, the mother, the hetera, and the medium. David often remarked that I was too independent and overly Amazon, and that that could be exhausting. We, of course, were working on the stance I had adopted in the world: need no one, don't speak unless spoken to, and be as self-sufficient as I could be. Essentially, another hard sell was my feminine type, the medial woman, who in Jung's terms was an anima woman. This is the woman who had no real identity of her own and was a screen for everyone's projections. True, because at that age, I still hadn't found myself. And so David helped me to find who I was underneath it all. I had to dare to show that, knowing in the past that if I asserted myself or wanted anything, it was immediately squelched. But we prevailed, and the combination of medial and intuitive, grounded in feeling, grounded in values, aesthetics, began to frame my identity. A major outcome of the typology adjustment was that I had to become strong enough to defend who I was becoming, or should I say, the me that was emerging. My persona was shifting. My ability to function in ways that professors and training committee expected was no longer possible. I had four major obstacles to overcome to claim a PhD degree and a Jungian diploma. The first was comprehensive exams, the easiest of the four in that they were written, and I could take my time within a 12-hour limit on 2 days. The second was very scary, the propedeutikum exams for advancement in Jungian training. These were oral, and it was here that my voice, my need to have a voice, and my need to defend my position against what seemed heated or hostile opposition, that was the longest week of my life. I did survive, but I knew there was so much work ahead on gaining a strong voice of my own. The PhD dissertation was the next obstacle, and finding a topic I was truly interested in and then defending that the work was at times an impossible task. David would read me fairy tales, and he would have me study fairy tales about the feats of extraordinary effort, and that somehow worked to get me to rally. The Jungian thesis. By the time I got to it, I was more myself, and that went much better. I had come into my own academic voice and was ready for the next phase of my life, away from academia and into the analytical space with people. Related to, and just as important as typology, was the work David called The Redemption of the Feminine. In my background, I had a positive feminine presence, my grandmother, and a negative presence, my raging mother. My grandmother was not valued by her husband. She was subject to his battering and verbal abuse. She nevertheless was a loving woman to me, and her musical gifts were also mine. I did not identify as a feminine being, rather tried to be neutral so as not to attract much attention, either positive nor negative. I could tell you all kinds of details about the culture in the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s that reinforced the devaluing of the feminine that I experienced, the same attitudes in my early life and again in graduate school or in the culture at large. Those same attitudes remain today in the world at large for many, many women of the world. But David believed that it is the work of every human, man or woman, to redeem the feminine within and to act according in the world. Emma Jung had a 30-year study, I suppose you could call it preoccupation with the Grail legend. She was interested in it because of the prominence of the feminine element, the magical, the irrational, and all of the beautiful women and the hideous women. Her work on anima and animus, in her own quiet way, began the process of countering the definition of the anima according to her husband, Carl Jung. The main theme in her work on the Grail legend was the offense to the feminine and in its various forms, the various kinds of offenses. The story of Blanche Fleur and her mistreatment by Percival, her abandonment and subsequent punishment by the jealous knight who possessed her, as well as other women Percival violated, without saying, points to the serious flaws of the so-called purest knight who sought the Grail. Years later, Percival encounters Blanche Fleur, a ragged, pitiful damsel on a nag of a horse. He does not recognize her. He only realizes his offense when he awakens the next morning and finds 3 drops of blood in the snow, reminding him of her beautiful countenance, snow white and rose red. In her own life, the witness to Emma's dilemma and her own silence was disturbing to David. Consciously or unconsciously, he determined that the redemption of the feminine was a task that must be undertaken by everyone, man or woman. What he observed was that, we had a play here not too many years ago that was about this topic. It was about the place of Toni Wolff and Emma Jung in Carl Jung's life. But what David observed was her depression and her sadness. And the fact is that Jung brought Toni Wolff into their family and referred to her as his second wife. That was so disturbing to see his analyst, who he loved, treated in this way, that I think it changed his perspective on what his life work was to be. And one of the reasons he really loved fairy tales is it's about the redemption of both the masculine and the feminine, but in many of them, very graphically, the redemption of the feminine. What is the feminine? Well, it's the ground of our being. We can't hate it. We came from our mothers. C.A. Meyer says nature herself is the matrix of all life. Gaia. He didn't call it Gaia, but the Gaia theory of today was exactly what C.A. Meyer was writing about as early as 1948. So I can't tell you what the feminine is, but I'll give you a story, since after all, David's way was to tell a story. And this is a story that helped me immensely. And it's the story of Dame Ranyel, the hideous damsel. Arthur goes on a hunt with his knights. He's separated from them. He sees a beautiful hart and he kills it. And as he is dressing his kill, a mighty knight comes to stand beside him. The knight says, "You have done me mighty harm, and I hold thy life before this day is done." Arthur, in his cunning, asks the knight for his name. The man says, "Gomer Somer Jure." Arthur said, "I have no idea who you are, sir." But Gomer Somer Jure was touched that Arthur had asked who he was, who was about to take his life. And he said, "If you can solve this riddle that I put to you, and I give you a month and a day, I'll release you." And Arthur agreed. And the knight says, "What is it that a woman most desires in all the world?" Arthur goes back to the castle and is in great dejection, for he knows not what a woman wants. And he calls his knights together. They are going to ride out through the kingdom asking this question and come back to him. When the month is nearly gone, comes to Arthur the most ugly hag mankind has ever seen. Face red, nose snotted, mouth wide, teeth yellow and hanging down over her lip, and a long thin neck and hanging heavy paps. She carried a lute and was riding a richly saddled palfrey. She rode directly to the king, and she gave him a greeting, and she said, "Grant me one thing, and I will tell you what a woman wants. I will make warranting for your life, or else you'll lose your head." He says, "What are your conditions?" And she said, "I will marry your fairest knight, Sir Gawain." They all gasp. But Sir Gawain steps forward and says, "It's okay. I'd rather be dead than thee." The marriage was arranged that day, and he was married, the fairest knight, to the foulest maid. And she says to Arthur, "What we desire above all else is to have sovereignty." And Arthur still didn't get it. And how this plays out is that on the wedding night, Gawain prepares to turn away from her, but she said, "I will have my embrace." He turns to her, and she is wondrously beautiful, and they have a passionate night. The next morning she says, "Now you must choose. You can have me fair by night, but foul by day, or your friends can't know, and they'll pity you. Or you can have me fair by day and foul by night and save face, but you'll not have enjoyment of me." Gawain allows her to choose, since it is she who must suffer. That breaks the curse, and she is free to be beautiful all the time, because a man gave her sovereignty over the conditions of her and his life. Then the riddle is solved, and the king is saved, and the kingdom rejoices. And that is what a woman wants. So this is the way we worked. The way we worked, I'd bring up a problem, he'd have a story. I'd bring up a problem, he would be silent, and he would ask me what I thought that story meant. This went on. And it worked its magic on me. There was a time when I realized that I was really becoming that feminine being that he valued, who was a feeling type and who was a medium. And as time went by, it got more comfortable. As time went by, I learned how to defend myself. I learned how to set boundaries, not always gracefully. But I had a voice in the world. I've got my watch here. It's a big clock. I'd kind of like us to take a break now, because what I'd like to go into is the work that I've done regarding music and the finding of the voice of the self. So you usually get 15 minutes, so come back about 5 after 8. This is his 5th recording, and he did it at the age of 70. And I picked that particular version of it because at the age of 69, I'm starting my cello journey, and he's finishing his cello journey. So. I have a lot of information about Bach, and I can see by the clock that I'll have time to give that to you. I was going to cut it, and I think we'll have plenty of time for that. Another gift of feeling was experienced within my own dreaming life. As David and I worked on my life and my struggles, to value myself, an inner presence of support began to grow. I began to have what I called the David dreams. They were very simple, and except for the dreams of the last few years, they were entirely nonverbal. The dreams came in synchronicity with an outer need for support. Just when I thought I couldn't do something, like the propedeuticum, or the PhD defense, or a lecture, or a confrontation with someone I was wary of, I would have a David dream. In the dream, the feeling was safe and warm, and the setting was most often in the mountains, or in a meadow, or once in an underground grotto. I would be walking, and suddenly he would just be there. There would be no words, but I felt immensely stronger and capable and up to whatever it was I had to do. I would wake up with a new reserve, and the day went easier. C.A. Meyer believed that the true transference and countertransference is in the psychic space shared by the two working together. That was true for me. When I needed help, help was at hand. The last gift of feeling comes over the course of my life as I have been in and out of relationship to music and to my musical voice. C.A. Meyer said that what wounded you can heal you. That simple statement is the whole of it, yet so difficult to describe and easier said than done. To identify the wound that is the wound that won't heal and is the key to everything else, that can take a lifetime. At least it has for me. Having given up consciously my ego voice at the age of 10 or 11, and having lost the musical voice I thought was mine at 17, I have come to see in retrospect that the gaining of both an inner and an outer voice was or perhaps the only way to see my work. The gaining of a specific voice, that is the mysterious work of the self, and not something I could have predicted. My loss of voice, literally, for instance, not being able to speak on the phone, because I couldn't make the phone diaphragm vibrate, and the loss of the inner voice can be described thus. This is a quote from C.A. Meyer. Asclepius cares for psyche, komsoma, both body and mind, and bodily sickness and psychic defect were for the ancient world an inseparable entity. The symptom is an expression of sympatheia, the consensus, the conjunctio naturae, the point of correspondence between the inner and the outer. So the symptom of being voiceless and the wound that caused it and the carrying of that deficit, if you will, C.A. Meyer always said when you begin analysis, you should begin with one question. Was fehlt Ihnen? What do you lack? Because it is a lack that brings us into the analytical room. We feel a deep lack. We feel a deep disconnect. We can't describe it. We often don't have words for it. We only know something's missing. For me, literally, I was missing a voice, but also psychically, I was missing my voice when I met David. The synchronicity of having to talk on the telephone kind of blew my mind. I thought, of all the analysts in the world, why do you have to live across the country? And it took a while for me to be able to be heard on the phone and to have the voice I needed in order to describe to him those early years. C.A. Meyer says that they are numbered, so it doesn't really matter. The key to healing is finding the door into the psyche and into the nature of the imbalance. In the ancient world, the process of healing entailed a journey to the healing center, a cult center of Apollo and Asclepius, such as Delphi, Epidaurus, Tiber Island in Rome, many centers, and there to petition to the gods for help, offerings, dream incubation, prescriptions, and rituals undertaken, all to invoke the help and the healing at the hands of Asclepius or Apollo, or in the case of women, Hygieia. Marvelous cures have a tendency to occur in particular places, for sanctity is bound to location. This continues in present time to Lourdes and to places of visitation by the Virgin. In those centers, the dream was the door, and in the present day of dream-centered analysis, the dream record is both the door and the path to healing. The ritual of incubation imitates death and rebirth. The patient is prepared for dreaming and wrapped in a shroud, placed in a small space like a catacomb and left to sleep and to dream. The dream tells the outcome toward new life or toward some other process. Some of the preparatory rituals included the rites of music and dance. The paintings in the Thalus of Epidaurus show the god Eros hanging up his bow and arrow and taking up a lyre, renouncing dangerous weapons and making music instead. It was Chiron the centaur who taught music and the healing arts to Asclepius, and in turn Asclepius taught the physicians medicine and turned their minds to music and made them just men. Just is the word for balanced, or tuned in our modern vernacular of just temperament is what we apply to the piano when we're tuning it. The dreams into my illness, my lack, began probably the third year that I was working with David. when I was having the most trouble getting ready for oral exams, propedeuticum, trying to find a thesis topic, thrashing around, really. I really wasn't settled in my academic work. The recurring dream, though, was not about academic work. The recurring dream that began to relentlessly and insistently try to focus my work where we're always exactly the same with little variation. I would see my violin case on a table across the room. I would approach it with great dread. I would open the case, and there would lie the smashed body of my beautiful red violin. I would fall to the floor, weeping inconsolably. This dream was the goad that kept me at my music. In graduate school, I balanced graduate school with, as I called it, the motley crew of the Boulder Symphony, with that funny little trio I played in. When I arrived in Seattle in 1978, the first thing I did is look for a musical group, and I found one. I found and auditioned for a 15-string Baroque chamber group. We were good enough to give concerts, for which we hired players from the Seattle Symphony if we needed woodwinds and brass, and from the Seattle Opera if we were performing The Messiah at Christmas. I was getting very good at that style of music, and from time to time, the mystical aspects of playing would grip me. One evening, the principal violinist was ill, and I took her place. It all came together for me that night, and on the adagio of one of the works, it was as if a sweet essence flowed through my hands. One of the cellists remarked that that was something she had never heard, and she thanked me. After that evening, the dream repeated itself. Only this time, when I opened the case, the violin was intact. And a violin maker was present and said, "Fine violins can be restored, even if they have been soaked in salt water." The conductor was a cellist, and he became a friend, and he gave me music lessons. And one day he remarked, "I hear what you're trying to say, and for that you need a much larger voice. I think a cello, but for expediency, I could use a good violist." I did switch to viola, and I found a teacher, and I worked as best I could to meet his very classical and traditional perfectionistic demands, but his style was reminiscent of the old days of critical abuse. I had a dream that set the course. In the dream, I was at the Alhambra in Andalusia, Spain. I had my viola with me. I was being given a tour by an imam, and I was taken to the underground chamber beneath the old fortress. There in the basement were old, sick, weak, impoverished men wearing rags, all lumpish in their dishevelment. I was moved to tears, and the imam said, "Play Bach for them, Anne." We had contacted my deeply depressed animus, for David said, when a woman is depressed, it is the animus who is depressed. After that dream, I quit the critical teacher, and I went my own way. I got a copy of the Bach suites and began the work of playing only those suites, coming to a place where I could play all six of them. Why Bach? Well, other than it being totally delicious, I have time, so I'm going to give you what I had put together about Bach and about the Bach suites. Bach was born in 1685 in Eisenach, and he died in July of 1750. His father was a musician who was the son of a musician, and so on, going back to the 16th century. Bach's first job was at age 18 in 1703 in the minor court of Weimar. He was hired as a violinist and a court lackey, meaning non-musical tasks and valet service. He was sent to evaluate an organ in the town of Arnstadt, and in that process, so awed the authorities with his playing that he was hired on the spot as the church organist. He came back to the Weimar court, and for a decade, starting in 1708, he mastered composition and began his works for solo instruments, initially for the violin. In 1717, the Kapellmeister of Weimar died, and Bach wanted the job, which he did not get. He was a father of four children by then and needed a better position. He was offered a position in Kirchen, and when he asked the Duke Wilhelm Ernst for permission to leave Weimar, the Duke imprisoned him in the castle jail. An old account by a student of Bach's said that he began writing the well-tempered clavier while in prison. However, if you analyze the Bach suites, the beginning of the work, with its simple chords, sounds unmistakably like the prelude to the first cello suite. It is quite possible that forced to fall back to his most basic creative skills, that he began writing the first cello suite while in jail. Another assumption is that he began the cello suites after his imprisonment around 1720 when he was 35. But the consensus is they were written from 1717 to 1724. The second suite is a lament for the death of his first wife in 1720, and the third suite is a celebration of his new marriage to Anna Magdalena Bach in 1721. Each suite follows the same format, a series of movements in dance form, a prelude, which is a dramatic opening statement, followed by a serious and solemn allemande, an aristocratic courant, a sarabande, which is the spiritual center of each suite, followed by one of three dance forms, a minuet, bourrée, or gavotte. And then each suite is capped with a fast-paced merry French jig. Why the cello? Were these suites written for the viola da gamba? It is speculated that his employer, Prince Leopold, was the musician for whom his viola da gamba works were written. He was an amateur, and the gamba works are of medium difficulty. Bach's solo works are virtuoso pieces, and it is argued that Bach would not have written them for the gamba so as not to embarrass his employer, who would not have been able to play them. The suites also are a study in melody and harmony. Bach's specialty was polyphonic harmony, the braiding of two or more musical lines. How does he do this on a cello, a monophonic instrument? He does this by creating implied harmony. He hints at it. He suggests it. He plants the seeds of musical lines, intertwining, stacking chords. He strips polyphony to its bare essentials and lets the listener fill in the blanks, like a jazz musician. He gives fragments of different lines from different registers, and he tricks us into thinking we are listening to more than one line at a time. Anner Bylsma, the French Baroque cellist, told us in a master class, think of a fencing match or a conversation between two people, a give and take, a back and forth of the lines. In his lifetime, Bach was not famous. Polyphony, his style, fell out of fashion. He never traveled to or lived in a major city. He never wrote an opera, which was the main way to fame in his day. Only nine of his works were printed in his career. The silence could not have been any deeper if his compositions had never existed at all. His legacy was through his sons, four of them, who became composers and teachers, and who made sure that their students played Bach's compositions. 40 years after his death, Mozart heard a Bach motet and said, "Now that's something one can learn from." And Beethoven first got attention at the age of 12, playing Bach's well-tempered clavier. The beginning of Bach's revival was specifically 1829, when a 20-year-old Felix Mendelssohn, who conducted a historic performance of Bach's St. Matthew's Passion, the oratorio that tells the story of the last days of Jesus. The cello suites are written without performance marks. There's no tempo marking, there's no bowing, there's no fingering, there's no dynamic. It's literally a Rorschach for each player, and you have to come to your own understanding of the suite, and you play it according to your own nature and to your level of skill and to your depth of understanding. The cello suites were lost for many years. There were two problems. One was the lowly nature of the cello itself. It was considered a drone for other instruments. The second issue is that there was only one known copy of it, and then copies were made of that copy, and that's the copy by Anna Magdalena Bloch, his young wife. In general, if they were played, they were played as exercises. It was to take the young Pablo Casals to reinvent the possibilities for the cello and to reintroduce the Bach suites to the world. He discovered a copy of them in 1890 in a small shop in Barcelona. He played them 10 years before he was brave enough to give the first public performance. This was the first public performance of the Bach suites in 1901. A full 280 years after they had been written. How could anyone think of Bach as cold, he says, when these suites seem to shine with the most glittering kind of poetry? As I got on with the study of them, I discovered a new world of space and beauty. The feelings I experienced were among the purest and most intense of my artistic life. Other artists have commented. Mario Brunello climbed to the summit of Mount Fuji and recorded parts of the cello suites in 2007 and declared that Bach's music comes closest to the absolute and to perfection. Eric Silban, in a just released quite marvelous book on the cello suites, says the genre may be Baroque, but there are multiple personalities and mood swings in the suites. I hear barnstorming, peasant tunes, postmodern minimalism, spiritual lamentation, heavy metal riff, medieval jigs, and spy movie soundtracks. Misha Maisky said he never stopped playing the suites once he began, except for the time he was in the gulag in Russia. He says the suites are like a great diamond, with so many different cuts that reflect the light in so many different ways. It requires incredible concentration and energy. That's the reason, he says, when I play three suites at a concert, I always change three shirts because I am soaking wet and not because I'm making a fashion statement. The music we were playing in the background was Janis Starker at the age of 70, on the occasion of his fifth recording of the suites. And he said, playing Bach is a never-ending quest for beauty, as well, in some sense, for truth. One only hopes to get near it. As the years and decades go by, the understanding grows, while the technical means weaken. Let me say that I have meant this fifth recording to be my last statement about the suites, but certainly not the ultimate. As before, it was an enriching and humbling experience. Oliver Sacks explained why I needed music. In his book, Musicophilia, He talks about music being used as a form of therapy for anxiety and for depression and for melancholia. He said that music, and we know this now to be true, can be used in stroke rehabilitation. The words are there, and when combined with music, the use of music to restore the patterns and the rhythm of speech helps in the rehabilitation of a left brain speech center injury through the use of the right brain. The words are there, and the music helps get the words out. Music can be used to contact Alzheimer patients. They come immediately into present time. They know the songs and the information surrounding the songs. Why the cello? For me, as I'll go back to my prepared script in a minute, it came in a dream, and so I had to follow. But the cello is the most like the human voice. Its range is from 2 octaves below middle C to 2 octaves plus a fifth above middle C. In human terms, the range of basso profundo, baritone, tenor, contralto, alto, soprano, and lyric soprano. The full range of the human voice can be played on the cello. The cello evolved as a separate instrument from the time of Andrea Amati. Best example is the King cello built in 1572. The instrument developed through reduction of the body to lengthening the fingerboard, and the pattern called Stradivarius B became the popular model in 1740. So essentially we're playing instruments now that have not moved much further beyond 1740. I myself have a brand new cello that is a Strad B. It's as young as I am in terms of we're in training together. My teacher says you have to play it in tune because if you don't play it in tune, it becomes trained out of tune and you have to train your ear because otherwise you hear it that way. And so that's where I'm at in this process. Okay. The last part of this musical journey is also the last part of my work with David. He's 90. He's entering an assisted living center next week. His mind is wonderful, but he's frail. And I knew when I started this last round of work with him that I would be working with him until I couldn't anymore. I had a 15-year hiatus from playing string music because of the physical pain of playing the viola and those old issues of back and neck. I tried other things like keyboard, but I'm not a keyboardist. I just don't get it, and it's too percussive. So I went a long time, 15 years, without actively playing music. About 4 years ago, I had a David dream, and I knew it was time that we start up again. This time for the examination of the last phases of life, and this time for the self, for the individuating piece. David and I believe that the self wants to live in life. It wants to come through. It wants a life. In the beginning of life, we need a persona to have an ego in the world. But in this stage of life, the self needs a vehicle, me, to have a persona, something through which to sound, is literally what persona means. The self wants a voice in the world. My self wants stringed instruments. Anne is not sufficient. It wants music. The dream that started it up again was the only one in which David has ever spoken to me. And there were several scenes, And in the last scene, which is at the end of David's workshop, he and I are cooking supper and relaxing, the way two, you know, feeling sensate types can do when we're just kind of hanging out. And he turns to me and he says, "How goes your music?" And I woke up and I'm going, "Oh my God, I don't have any music. I've gone dry. The well is dry." That began the present journey. And in the process of that, I went back. I tried the keyboard. I really did. I just didn't like it. And about a year and a half ago, I decided to get the viola out and to see if maybe after 15 years of quiescence, I could play it. But within a month, I was kind of walking around like, you know, Igor again, and the pain of it's a heavy instrument. It isn't meant for a human body, or at least my body. I was pretty discouraged, and so I incubated a dream. I asked for help. I wanted to know what to do about this. And I dreamt a cello playing the Bach suites. I leaped out of bed. I looked in the online, because you don't have to use the yellow pages anymore. We've got the god of Google. And I called the nearest violin shop, Bischoff Berger's, in St. Kirkland. And I made an appointment, and I said, I'm a former violist, violinist, but I want to try a cello, and can I rent one? And they said, sure, you know, come on over, and we'll have one ready by the time you get here. So I drive over, I get my cello, I went through my music, and I had an old copy of the Bach suites. And very naively, I mean, this is the truth, I pulled that cello out of the case, and I got the music set up, and I went, okay, I'm going to play this. Wow. The sound was so terrible that one of my cats took to the bed and was sitting in the bed stricken. And I thought, oh, dear. I nevertheless was excited. How awful. How awful. It sounded like I was torturing some poor animal. But how wonderful the instrument felt. And I sort of just held it all day. And I smelled it, and I smelled the rosin, and I put my arms around it. And then I'd try to find middle C, because I sort of knew on the viola that it was an octave difference. And so I found it, all right, I found it. And then I tried playing it again. And pretty soon I got one note. I got that one note. Cat still wasn't coming out. So then I thought, well, you know, this isn't going to be so easy. I can't just play the Bach suites. I'm going to have a teacher. So I went online to find a teacher. And based on his compositions, which you could have samples of when you looked at his website, I found exactly the teacher I wanted, Sean Paul, a young man with a gift for melody who described his vision of the world and his own mysticism, and it matched my own. So I asked him, do you take older students? And he said yes, and we made an appointment, and I arrive. And by now I have Suzuki Book 1, and Sean says, well, now, can you do anything at all? So I got that cello out, and I hung my arm down like this on the fingerboard, and I turned the bow like this, and I made some terrible sound. And he said, well, that's perfect if you're playing the viola. And what to my surprise is that the cello and the violin and viola are exactly opposite. So the first 3 months, I was in heavy-duty right brain, left brain dilemma. I could feel my brain. I was so tired at night because viola, violin is this way. Cello is this way. Violin music goes this way. So, you know, when the violin music goes up like that, you pull the bow up like that. Cello music goes this way. And I thought, oh boy. Then, violin system is four fingers. Cello is three because of the distances. So everything had to be reassessed. And I was, you know, having a hard time. And I also, at the same time, could hear that this cello I had was inadequate already. Even though I couldn't play Suzuki Book One, I wanted my own cello because I had this idea in my head about what a proper cello should sound like. So way before would have been, you know, a good idea, I set out to find a cello and by some miracle have found a really lovely one who is going to grow with me. And it's a Strad B, which means the thickness of the wood will take at least 50 years for it to come into its full voice. I will be long gone. But right now, this cello is already quite beautiful. So I'm perfectly happy. Everything had to change. I had to learn new fingering. I had to learn to read bass clef. I had to get my hands reversed. And then there's the drastic tenor clef, which I'm 15 months later still trying to... You know, the viola and the cello tenor clef are one note off. And I look at that and I think it's a B. And it isn't. It's an A. And so I'm still adjusting to that aspect of it. Every week, I allow myself what I call a test. And I get out the box suites, and I see if I can play even a line. And one day, I went to my lesson, and I said, I could play the first two lines of the prelude to the third suite. And Sean said, well, that's a C major scale. And I said, I know. Isn't it wonderful? So, you know, these are small, small steps. My goal, of course, is that I will at some point be able to play all six of these suites if I live long enough. And I think I will. Why does my self want a cello as its chosen voice? You see, this is the part that C.A. Meyer says, you cannot second-guess the self. You cannot say what is good for the self. The self knows what's good for itself. You don't know what's good for it. And if you don't follow it, guess what? You have an unlived part of yourself that is the lack, that is the basis for the illnesses, the depressions, the anxiety, maybe the long illness I had in the 90s when I wasn't playing music. So I have learned that I have to give in to this voice. And it really doesn't matter if I ever play it in public or accomplish the virtuoso level that is needed for the box suites. It only matters that I am doing it. And I am doing it as best I can every day because it wants to be played at least an hour every day. Why is it my voice? Why is it the voice of the self? I think it's because it is a human voice. And when you play the cello, it plays you. It's the only instrument that you play while hugging. And you feel it. Your heart resonates with that cello. So it's a heart opener. It's an energetic purifier in energy terms. The cat likes the cello. He no longer hides in the bedroom. He comes out. He wants, and he lays on the floor like he's at a little concert, which is a big step because this is my scaredy cat who always goes to the bed if anything scares him. So I think, in summary, what I have to say about my long analysis or my long relationship with a man who gave me such value that I value myself is to recognize that what was lost, what I willingly gave up, that my voice, and then what was taken from me, music school, I lost those things. I had no voice in the world when I met David. I now have both a voice in the world and a persona as a woman of feeling and with a vocation that is a lineage of remarkable predecessors, David Hart, Emma Young, C.A. Meyer. And the lost musical voice, the true voice of the self, is now regained. The voice the self wants, a cello voice, is being nurtured by a young teacher who, like David, only wishes the best for me. Between them, I have a life of inner and outer richness and beauty. Thank you for listening.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.